Hi folks, and welcome to Righteous Kicks, the podcast where two science fiction writers geek out about men in spandex bodysuits who kick evildoers to death in abandoned quarries until they explode.
To be fair, these days we're doing it behind the school gymnasium.
This is indeed true. I'm Brandon.
And I'm Iori.
And we have a lot of feelings about Kamen Rider Forze.
As you may recall, it took me about 20 episodes to really emotionally invest in Kamen Rider Drive.
Mm-hmm.
This time, we hooked me in the first 3 minutes or so.
Yeah. Kisaragi Gentarō has that effect on people. He draws people in like that. But before we start having those feelings, we would have mentioned in a previous episode of Righteous Kicks that we are now in a new era in Japan. It is presently the Reiwa era. And with a new era comes a whole new series of riders that we have to eventually confront, starting with a series that is starting on September 1st, which is called Kamen Rider 01.
This also marks the introduction of the first female Kamen Rider! It's a new era, and sexism is over! Except not really, but let's pretend for a minute until the bit where she gets fridged, which I'm basically expecting.
Sexism is kinda over, maybe. And I mean, we should specify, there have been female riders before, but they've been not main, not mentioned in the press conference. They typically appear as anti-heroes or villains, or they will appear in Rider War stories like Kamen Rider Ryuki. And when they do, they're either someone's love interest, someone's subordinate, or dead. So we're kind of hopeful that the fact that this rider, Kamen Rider Valkyrie, having a name, having a character, having their own goals and intentions, will probably keep them alive longer.
If nothing else, having their own merchandise should help.
Especially considering that rushing cheetah form of Kamen Rider Valkyrie is actually really rad. It's one of the better designs of the entire show. So I actually really want her to stick around and keep getting, like, very cool-looking, not randomly feminized suit designs. Because so far Valkyrie's designs are the best of the show. And I say this saying that even though 01's designs in general are far and away much more distinct than a lot of Heisei's designs, they're all pretty good, but hers are best. So I just want to get all of her toys. So I'm kind of hoping that that also means that they will go, oh, people like her? Maybe we shouldn't kill her then.
One hopes,
because I have a lot of other hopes about that show as well. For context, the very short version of the plot is that in the present day, AI has become so commonplace that we can trust robots to do certain manual jobs for us. So there's this entire new generation of robots called Humagears that we can trust with taking care of our children and constructing buildings and all of these nice, interesting things. And
wait, hang on. Can we back up a second? I think we just actually described Chobits, but with fight scenes.
I guess that's technically where we've gone. Does Chobits also have a comedian who inherits his grandfather's share in a tech company?
No, it just has some rando dude who finds, like, a half-dead android in a dumpster and takes her home. And then it gets weirdly sexual. It's very uncomfortable.
Oh, God.
Character designs are gorgeous, though. Oh my God, those costumes.
I don't know how to feel about both of those statements in tandem, but I'll take it. So there are a lot of questions that I obviously have about how 01 will possibly handle AI questions, robot labor questions, considering that the main conflict is that digital terrorists who hate humanity start brainwashing some Humagears to attack humans. So the government creates an entire branch of the military to shoot them on sight. That sounds like it's leaning toward the kind of story that purposefully demonizes technology instead of holding humans responsible for technological bias. Just a little bit.
Yeah, I have reservations about it, but I did also come very close to punching a computer yesterday, so I can understand where this impulse is coming from on an emotional
But it wasn't the computer's fault. The computer didn't hate you.
Oh no, it was not the computer's fault. It was Google's fault, but it wasn't the computer's fault.
Right, and Google is a man's fault, so maybe shoot the man dead on sight, is what I'm really saying. Maybe.
Okay, now that we've endorsed a little bit of murder, I think it's time to get to the rest of the episode.
Oh god, yes. So, Kamen Rider Forze, I don't know where to start with all of my feeling. This is my fifth rewatch of Forze since it came out in 2011. My last rewatch was in 2015, so a lot of my feelings are still fresh. I kind of remember the entire show by heart.
This is my first time seeing it, and I am deeply charmed. It's like Persona 4 plus every high school movie possible.
Yeah.
I'm really enjoying this.
So the short version of the story is Kisaragi Gentaro has now been transferred to Amanogawa High School after a series of incidents have brought him back to his hometown. And he has made a personal pledge to himself that he will befriend everyone at his new school. That's what we know him for. That's his one driving characteristic in this entire show. But on his first day, he has some hiccups. He gets in a fight with one kid over that kid's refusal to accept a girl's love letter.
Hey, he should have at least read it.
He should have read it. He was an ass, but still. And then that lunchtime, he sits in the school queen's cafeteria seat and gets in a fight with the whole football team.
I want to highlight how great the cafeteria scene is because it really goes hard on the tropes. The writer's room for this just got their entire idea of high school by watching Heathers. So Gen walks into the cafeteria with his best friend Yuki, and she's like, okay, so that's where the geeks sit, that's where the jocks sit, those are the goths, stay away from them. And it's beautiful.
It's very Mean Girls. The part that I love about that moment in particular is that we're supposed to assume that Yuki and Gen are looking at them when the camera does that montage. So when she looks at, I can't remember which clique it was. Were they the thugs? What did she call them? But there is a kid who responds so viscerally by slamming a table. And I'm like, should I be worried for Yuki's life at this moment? Should she have said that aloud? But yes, those things happen. And then, in the middle of getting in a fight with the entire football team, a monster suddenly attacks them right outside the school. And the football team just leaves Gen to deal with it, to figure it out.
As you do.
Like, I mean, we were going to beat him up anyway, so I guess if he's gonna die by laser fire from this random monster, we might as well just leave him to it. And that's when his old elementary school friend Yuki, who just so happens to also be at the school, comes and saves him with the help of Kengo, the boy who he got in a fight with outside school for not accepting that girl's love letter.
And Kengo has construction equipment.
The Kengo is in this giant yellow robot that is attempting to beat this monster, this 6 foot, 7 foot monster, against Kengo in this giant robot called the Power Dizer, which is like maybe 11 feet, trying to beat this monster in a fist fight and losing. And that's when we eventually just kind of realize that, oh, this is a thing that happens in this school on a regular basis. They're just monsters that people just, I guess they've gotten accustomed to it. And Gentaro decides that if this is a thing that his best friend and her best friend consider their responsibility, then he wants to help them. So they entrust him with a belt that allows him to turn into Kamen Rider Forze, which is essentially just a spaceship with random powers. It's very cool. But it's also powered by friendship, so it's the like most endearing Kamen Rider ever for me.
I have to say that I'm not loving the suit aesthetic.
No?
No!
I think it's the raddest thing!
The limb markers are like PlayStation buttons?
Well, I mean, I thought that that was a thing. Like, there is, like, official Kamen Rider Forze, like, background to the entire, like, construction of the suit.
Oh, no, I understand how it's functional. I think it's ugly. I'm also not loving the whole cone head shape on the helmet, even though I get that it's supposed to have, like, aesthetic influence of the space shuttle.
Yes, I mean, all of these things are things that I like, though. I like that it's, like, just a shiny silver and black spaceship with sockets for switches to be turned on.
It is better than the electric version because in gold it looks insufficiently astronaut-y.
I mean, yeah, I can get that. I mean, I just... Something about this spaceship-headed, bug-eyed, white suit walking up to people on a high school campus and trying to save them from monsters and looking, like, just as jarring and disturbing as everything else that's happening around them, I actually kind of like. I mean, it is made even more outstanding by the fact that the suit has these tools called Astro Switches that allow the suit to access special powers and abilities that are attached to the suit's limbs. So there is a switch for the left arm, a switch for the right arm, a switch for the left leg, a switch for the right leg.
And honestly, for all the shit the other characters give Gen about being an airhead, I know with full confidence I would not be able to work that belt myself. I would absolutely mess up which switch goes into which socket or something.
I mean, there is that, but there's also the fact that some of those switches are in terrible places.
It's just a really complicated system.
Like, why would you make a pen switch and attach it to the right leg? Who draws with their... Like, why would you do that?
Wait. I thought the switches were modular and could be used in any socket. Are you telling me that that is wrong?
Nope. They are supposed to be used in a specific place.
Oh, God.
It's tragic. There are 10 switch modules per socket, and you can't put them anywhere else and use them. He can only draw with the pen switch module from his right leg. He can only pour water from the water switch from his left leg. Like, why would I have to lie down in order to produce water? Why do I need to raise my... I don't have the... Like, no, why? It's just so terrible. Some of those switches are non-functional, in my perspective. But yeah, that's where we are. That's Kamen Rider Forze, folks. You want to draw? I hope that your right leg is your dominant leg.
I'm sorry, I just need a minute.
Kind of pull back to something that you had mentioned earlier, which is how many teen television and film homages are in this series, because I totally forgot that some of the things that I thought had happened after this series had come out, in hindsight, were things that it had actually happened before it. Like, I forgot that Mean Girls actually precedes Forze by 7 years.
Probably the biggest thing here is the extended Breakfast Club homage, which is so obvious that both of us got it despite never having seen that movie.
Yeah, the gang's literally all there. Like, you just need to see a picture of a Breakfast Club poster, and everybody, look, it just fits. I mean, the Breakfast Club didn't have a Yankee with a pompadour, but still, technically.
Gen's a stand-in for, like, the rando drug dealer kid from the bad side of the tracks or something.
You know, yeah, I see it, technically.
I mean, visually, that's what his design is supposed to evoke.
Mm-hmm. So there's also a lot of Mean Girls. There's a reference to the craft that...
the craft walk was so good.
That we're going to have an entire conversation about, because I have a lot of feelings about that arc in particular. Those two episodes are brilliant, in my view.
But first, can we talk about Mew? Can we please talk about Mew, who is my favorite and whom I would die for?
We can talk about Mew. Kazashiro Mew is the school queen, captain of the cheerleading club. Very intense, very domineering. I have, like, I don't even know where to begin with her, because she, like, the very first time that we meet her, she just calls Gentaro trash to his face. And then he gets beat up, as previously acknowledged. And then we go right into one of the more interesting, like, double episode arcs of the beginning of the series, which is when she is in, like, the school Queen Fest competition, attempting to...
This is essentially, like, our attempt to have a prom episode without a prom.
Close enough, because we're going to have a prom episode and you're going to have feelings, but...
Oh, no. I am looking forward to it.
Oh, yes. This is our talent show arc, where, out of nowhere, just to give a kind of sense of how intense Gentaro is at the act of befriending people, by the way, he walks up to Mew one morning as the Queen Fest is being advertised, and asks very sternly why she isn't even looking at any of the gifts that all of her classmates are showering her with. And she essentially goes, well, that's not my job. They're showering me with affection. I don't need to accept that visibly from them right now. And at that moment, Gentaro decides to make a dare, which is, if you lose the Queen Fest, Mew, you have to be my friend.
And if you win, I'll drop out of school.
I will drop out of school if you win. It's like, I wasn't staking my entire school career on the most popular girl at school being less popular all of a sudden, but okay. So that happened. And that double episode is a trip. A lot happens. For us to get into exactly what happens, we also need to qualify what the monsters in the show technically are, in brief, which are essentially other students who are given a special kind of switch called a Zodiarts switch that allows them to turn into a creature known as a Zodiarts, which is monsters that are based on the constellations. And they're almost always students who have, like, very passionate negative feelings about the experience of being in school.
They have grudges, they have jealousy.
They have insecurities, they have fears, they have hopes, even. Many a time we will discover that a child has been manipulated into thinking that this is going to give them the ability to do good things.
Being a kid is rough.
Right? So, what is particularly important in Mew's case when we learn more about the Queen Fest is she isn't actually that nice of a person. She, like, destroys people's gifts.
In fairness, that DVD was mega creepy. If somebody gave me a DVD full of pictures of me, I would be deeply alarmed.
That part, yes, that's fair. And it's part of why I still understood how everything went down at the end of it. But why would you destroy someone's letter because it's illegible? It looked legible to me, and I don't even read Japanese text. It's like, anyhow. But as that entire scene continues, we are also learning that other contestants in the Queen Fest have found themselves mysteriously, seriously injured by some invisible force. And as such, they have decided to drop out of the competition because they seem to be targeted, and they don't like that. Gentaro finds out because he literally looks for a girl to enter the Queen Fest. He tries to find a second popular girl. And is like, please, enter the Queen Fest so I don't have to drop out of school. And then she is attacked by an invisible force in a classroom and immediately decides, nope, I'm done. I want nothing to do with the thing.
Fair.
Perfectly fair, yes. And that same invisible force attacks Mew on the first day of the Queen Fest, on stage in front of everybody, and then we learn that it is actually a Zodiarts as well. It is the Chameleon Zodiarts, right, I was trying to remember its name.
Is that an actual constellation?
It is.
or the name of a star or something.
Chameleon is actually a constellation. Everything is definitely a confirmed constellation. They may not always go by an official name, and some of them technically don't exist anymore, but in 2011 they did all exist. Constellations are weird.
Okay, I definitely had this moment of like, I do not remember this from my astronomy class.
So yeah, a lot of Mew's arc in those two episodes are also attached to the fact that as she destroyed all of those gifts, there was actually a secret tape of her destroying them. And it ruins her reputation in school, and the students no longer like her, because why would you do that to people who are being nice to you and gifting you with all of their deepest, most heartfelt, creepy DVDs? And that ruins her reputation, and people no longer want to speak with her, and she's no longer popular, and that happens. Which is a thing that in another show I would have been like, yes, she has gotten her comeuppance. But I had feelings.
We find out that the Zodiarts is actually one of her little henchwomen.
That's a way to put it.
Who is now, okay, this is like when the first Heather gets murdered, and the next Heather takes the scrunchie.
Yeah! That was it. I had so many feelings there, in particular.
And during this, Mew gets so attacked so viciously by her now chameleonized ex-friend that she winds up in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Seriously injured. And while this is, like, around the same time that happens, Gentaro has had this, like, sudden passionate change of heart where he confronts Mew and says, well, you can't let this one insecure henchwoman ruin your entire career of ruthless popularity. This is the part where you kind of like regain your resolve and go be the bad bitch that you've been this entire time. And I vividly remember going at this moment, isn't your education at risk, Gentaro? But okay, I guess I see where you're coming from.
And Mew storms the talent show in her bandages, on her crutches, and she explains herself.
No, and let's be clear exactly how that happens. She comes back into the hall, especially after said henchwoman, who has, like, this is the day after, totally battering Mew and leaving her in the hospital. Every other competitor in the Queenfest knows that it's her at this point, especially Yuki, who saw it happen and also does not want to be a part of this because she's only in the Queenfest specifically as a kind of, like, bait. And now that we know exactly what's happening, I have no idea why she's still in the competition, but still. And said henchwoman has given this long, embattled speech about how Mew never loved you. Mew had no respect for you at all. You deserve a queen that actually loves you and will actually accept all of your gifts for what they are.
Spoilers, she doesn't.
She doesn't give a fuck either. She's even colder, but still. And then Mew storms in, and the crowd immediately turns against her and is shouting for her to leave. And Mew raises her crutches and slams it down on the floor, and everybody is silent in this, like, pure power move moment that I didn't believe was going to happen, and they gave it to us. And she explains to the crowd, you didn't give me these gifts because you thought that I would like them. You gave me these gifts out of your own self-interest. If you really want to make someone happy, you give them something that you think that they will actually accept and enjoy. Anything less is selfishness on your part. I worked hard to be here, and I deserve the fruits of my own effort. Anybody who's going to sabotage that work for me doesn't deserve to be here. You know it. I know it. I deserve to be queen. And everybody's like, you know, that's still cold as ice, but we agree with you. It was brilliant.
And the thing is, aside from the half-assed cheer routine she had done on the first day, she is a hard worker. And this gets fleshed out a lot in later episodes. Oh my gosh. After this arc is over, she becomes one of the best characters.
Very rapidly, in fact. And also about that cheer routine, I am baffled by the fact that those school skirts are so short. Disturbed the hell out of me. I was troubled throughout that entire, like, guys, don't move so vigorously. Fabric is moving. Don't do that to these people.
Have you noticed that in their normal uniform, Mew actually has a longer skirt than most of the other girls because she's attached this lace detailing that gives her like an extra inch of cover?
I did in fact notice. I thought that that was a thing. That was kind of neat.
It's very good character detail.
We have a lot of thoughts about costumes too. We should probably get to that briefly before we deal with the rest of the Breakfast Club. Like, all of the main characters in the show kind of are not wearing school uniforms.
No, Kengel and Yuki have the normal uniforms because they're the every kid. Gen wears a cropped version of a Gakuran, which, okay, midriff. Interesting choices.
Mm-hmm. Plus, I'm sure that pompadour is not legal.
Shun lives in his Leatherman jacket.
Yes.
Mew starts off wearing the cheerleader costume pretty frequently. As we go through the series, she's going to wear her normal school uniform more and more as she realizes, hey, hanging out on the literal-ass moon is so much more fun than hanging out with other cheerleaders.
Yep.
And Jake is trapped in an early 2000s Cocolulu catalog. Someone send him help. Get the rescue team.
Jake is actually, like, for a character that is not my favorite in the main cast, Jake's clothing choices are actually higher up than most, even though they're kind of understated compared to some others.
You can't call those colors understated. You could spot him in a crowd at 50 paces.
Under Jake's school jacket are these, like, very vigorous, just a shade darker than pastel, just, like, layers under his jacket for no reason. Like, they're just there, drawing attention to themselves.
Oh, the point of it being under the jacket is so that he's just barely skirting uniform code to get away with it.
Oh yeah, definitely. He seems like the kind of guy who wouldn't, under normal circumstances, would not have worn that jacket in the first place. It's just, oh my god, like, brilliant. And part of the reason why I like those things in particular is because I'm sure all of those things are just illegal enough that someone should correct them about those decisions. But the only person who ever gets any flack for his uniform is Gentaro, because he's just not wearing any of it.
Yeah, he's wearing a uniform, just not this school's uniform, whereas everybody else is at least wearing something that was given to them by the school, even if they've made modifications.
Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that Gentaro's argument is always, well, I transferred here, and everyone, but it's been months. You've been here until it turned winter, maybe you should change your uniform now.
I want to know where his parents are.
That's a thing.
I kind of thought it would be.
I'm sorry. God. I'm actually kind of surprised that it didn't come up yet in 16 episodes, but it's a thing.
Oh no.
It's a thing.
Oh no.
Do I need to qualify it for you now?
He wants to be friends with everyone because he's a tragic orphan, isn't he?
Yeah!
Okay.
His parents have passed on. He's living with his grandfather here. It becomes a thing later. It just never comes up because he's not a sad person. He legitimately has all of this energy. He is that hype all the time. This is who he is.
Which is probably why he seems to gel well with Jake at first.
Yes. Gentaro is an interesting character in that he reads very well as a certain kind of character, but has so many seemingly contradictory layers that it's very easy to see how he gels with everybody. He's very gruff and does not follow authoritarian rules, so it looks like he will mesh well with Jake, but that doesn't go the way that we thought it was going to go.
Partly because Jake's a little shit, and partly because Gentaro actually seems to have a little bit of social anxiety in crowds. When he goes to Jake's party, he's amazingly ill at ease, which is interesting because from a social perspective, they should be running together. They both have fashion markers of being bad kids, quote unquote. And although those go in slightly divergent directions, they are people who random observers would expect to hang out together.
Mm-hmm.
The girls that Jake has at his party are the kind of girls that Gentaro would be expected to hang out with in a normal high school setting.
This is true.
That over-the-top fashion, the tanning, the bleaching, the huge, loud makeup. Because they are both using fashion markers to indicate rebellion.
Mm-hmm. But the thing about Gentaro's style is it's not a deliberately rebellious style. It's just his style. Which is what makes him so, like, peculiar and unique. He's just a mashup of things. He's a very good street fighter who also tends to be unnecessarily poetic in random conversation. He seems very brash and thuggish, but his phone's ringtone is an Enka song.
Oh, that goes with the Gakuran.
Yeah, fair.
Like, the Gakuran is also a super retro thing, so that he would be into retro music to go with it, that doesn't seem incongruent. He's committed to an aesthetic here.
It's a very intense aesthetic, and I love it a lot. I love that people automatically assume as a result that he is not friendly.
Well, yes, he is basically wearing the uniform of, don't talk to me.
Uh-huh. And then he shows up at your house to see your teenage daughter because he wants to befriend her. And you look at him and go, he doesn't look like an upright person. He might be up to something. So very interesting.
I mean, I kind of understand why Tomoko's family was alarmed. He looks like he's going to loan shark her.
That's one of many assumptions that one can make.
He's picked a fashion style that has certain stereotypes associated with it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those stereotypes is, you know, minor criminal activity.
Minor? Cool. So we should probably talk about the rest of what we're going to call the Breakfast Club. But it already has a name. It's called the Kamen Rider Club. So since we're going in order, in terms of their arcs, because we've already witnessed Miu's arc, which is episode 3 and episode 4, we should probably talk about Jake.
What a little shit.
Oh my god. Jake is terrible.
The worst.
So Jake's whole thing, after seeing all of the events of the first few episodes, of witnessing Gen, Kengo and Yuki use this massive space-based power to defeat all of the monsters on campus, he immediately latches on to Gentaro and insists, you know, we should be friends. You like friends, don't you? I'm having a party tomorrow night. You should come and we should be friends. And Gen is confused and put off, but he decides, hey, friends, let's just do the thing and see. As that's happening, we also learn that a member of the fencing club has a vendetta against Jake for as yet unstated reasons, but we eventually learn that it's because Jake was once this boy's friend.
Let's just put some heavy quotation marks on that.
Friend was once his acquaintance. He was once his bodyguard. And while walking from school one day, a group of thugs beat him up, and Jake watched him get beat up and ran. And at that point he was like, oh, you don't care about anybody, do you? I'm going to stab you to death, as one does. So Jake's entire thing at this point is that he only wants Gen around so Gen can fight for him. And part of how he does that is when he discovers that Forze has a new switch, which is the LX switch, which allows him to take a whole new state and control electricity at will. Jake just steals the switch. He can't do anything with it. He's just like, oh, it has great power. I want it. Maybe it will keep Gentaro around long enough that he'll just continue getting beat up on my behalf. That goes poorly, as one would expect, because the lie is eventually revealed and Gentaro, hurt and confused, loses yet another fight against this kid who has assumed the the Unicorn Zodiacs, which has this very interesting secondary power of turning its head into a fencing sword, but that I just thought that was very cool. And in the process of losing that fight, Jake is kidnapped, and that Zodiacs gives him an ultimatum, which is, you have 1 hour to call any friend that you have. They don't need to fight for you, they just need to show up. They just need to be present. And if you can't get somebody to come and see you in 1 hour, I will kill you. And that entire moment is a lot of feelings for one particular reason. Can you guess what that reason is?
Yen is the only one who shows up.
Not just that he's the only one that shows up. After Jake literally looking him in the eye and saying, friends don't matter to me. Friends are naive and can be used. I'm just taking advantage of people whenever I get the chance. It's the fact that Jake has Gentaro's number and sees it and is given the opportunity to call him.
And he doesn't.
But he's the one that he doesn't call. He genuinely feels shame in that moment. This is someone who he knows at that point would be willing to show up even after he's done such a hurtful thing to Gentaro. He knows that if he calls, Gentaro would show up. And Gentaro shows up without learning anything. And Jake actually asks him, well, why did you come? It's like, I mean, you're kind of shitty, but friends accept the worst parts of each other. So I'm gonna do that now.
I actually did not love this as Aesop, just because, like, I mean, yes, but also you need to have boundaries. Boundaries are really, really important just for your own mental health.
Gentaro has no boundaries.
Yeah, Gentaro super doesn't have boundaries.
It's probably bad. It's bad. We will learn in future episodes that it's terrible. But he has, he's not filtered like that. He's 100% pure, earnest friend material.
Okay, that's a nice way to say it. I was going to just go with sets himself on fire to keep everybody else warm.
Yeah, those are the same things. That's, synonyms.
And I feel like, let's maybe not lionize that so much. Because this is extremely a good way to get your ass kicked. Emotionally, physically, mentally.
Oh yeah. Oh my god. You're gonna see Gentaro willingly get his ass kicked very often. You're gonna oh my god. Oh my. Iori. I am sorry for you in advance. This is a show.
Am I just going to just sit here in my corner and keep screaming, somebody have some boundaries?
You're gonna learn so much about Kisaragi Gentaro and the people around him. And I am excited to see you learn those things. And the thing is, immediately leaving this arc, we go into another arc of him deliberately lacking boundaries. Which is, remember when I said that Gentaro got beat up by the football team? This is the arc dedicated to the captain of the football team.
Who, incidentally, is a little bit to blame for that first Zodiarts attacking the school in episodes 1 and 2. Because that had been, like, the team water boy who was getting hazed.
Yeah, that was a whole thing.
All Miura wanted was to taste the epic highs and lows of American high school football.
Oh my god. Oh my god. Is that you literally quoted Riverdale to us. Why did you do this to me?
Because that's the genuine theme of Miura's initial character arc and also Shun's character arc.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you are not wrong. Shun is my baby.
Well, that and daddy issues.
You're supposed to hate Shun, because Shun is like the kind of kid that you hate in shows like this, but I love him. Because his whole thing is, he's only in the football team in the first place to impress his dad. He's only in a relationship with a whole other human being in order to impress his father. Which is terrible and wrong and kind of weird and creepy, but still.
He's a mess.
He's a whole mess. So just after the football team has won regionals, which I did not know was a thing in Japan. I didn't know American football was a thing.
Oh yeah, it totally is. All the schools here do have amifuto clubs, and most sports are initially on a municipal level.
then regional, then you go to nationals.
Mm-hmm. It struck me as so very American in a way that I thought was curious, but I loved it because it was immediately the thing that I recognized. It's like, yes, this is the trope that we're going for. But Hyun's problem now is after they have won regionals, he needs to take a supplementary class after school because he's been falling behind on his studies, and it's the worst after school program ever because its teacher, Professor Satake, is fucking terrible.
It turns out that Satake is actually just venting his own father-son problems on all his students, which is deeply uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Very violently and unsettlingly. For context, if you haven't seen that episode, Satake-sensei has a staff, like a 6-foot-long rod, with the text, "The heart is a white canvas," taped to the top of it. And that is what he uses to threaten people. It's just so wrong. But because everybody else just so happens to be in the supplementary class for other very distinct reasons, and Gentaro's reason is because his uniform hasn't changed yet, this gives Gentaro and Hyun this prime example for them to finally be friends, which Hyun does not like or accept at all, because he's lost his girl.
Hyun actively starts trying to prevent them from fighting the Zodiarts.
I mean, that happens.
Also, just let's rewind to Mew briefly, whom I love, because she just went out there and she challenged the monster, basically alone. I mean, Jake's useless in a fight, so she was basically alone. And she was just like, yeah, I have some feelings about justice now and protecting people, and I'm gonna just go for it.
Yeah, it's such a brilliant scene because we're seeing this Zodiarts, the Hound Zodiarts, going, like, walking towards police officers who are shooting him in the face and doing nothing to him. And Mew just turns a corner behind some building and goes, "We will not allow you to wreak havoc on our city." And Jake is just dragging her by the elbow going, "Do you want to die?" It's like, I mean, he's right. What are you doing? Please.
I love how passionately fighty she is. And it's great how Hyun is shocked by this, because he's like, wait, Mew cares about things? Mew has a personality and is a person, and I never noticed the whole time we were dating? Oh my gosh.
I'm upset.
And also, Mew gets in the robot.
Oh yes.
She goes there.
Like, she gets into the giant Powerdizer robot and gets in a fight and actually holds her own.
I have so many feelings about this. Like, I'm so proud of her.
Uh-huh.
Also, let's be completely realistic here. The bit where Mew is too weak to pilot the Powerdizer is a complete flimsy ass pull just to foreground Hyun, because cheerleaders are basically like rage-powered muscle engines. There is no realistic way that she should not have been able to power that. She's made of core strength!
So this is a thing that I kind of headcanoned, because you don't really see the cockpit of the Powerdizer very clearly. But the movements that Hyun makes, the movement that Hyun's actor, Justin Tomimori, makes in the Powerdizer in those scenes, give me a kind of impression that the limbs are literally attached to his limbs. So there is that as well. I don't think that most average teenagers have the limb strength capable of actually moving this, like, heavy metal 4-foot brace and trying to hit something with it. So that's just me.
Average teenager, yes, but she's not an average teenager. She's a cheerleader. She can probably do shit like, I don't know, stand on her hands for 10 minutes? Like...
fair. I accept that. But, like, as we see in those two episodes, Hyun's entire, like, frustration is that up to this point, he's lost so much deliberately because of Gentaro. He blames Gentaro for Miura revealing himself to be a Zodiata and trying to kill him. But that's not his fault.
That's very not Gen's fault.
He blames Gen for stealing Mew from him, but Mew just joined the club after Gentaro saved her life.
Mew is the one who declared it a club.
And also, she's her own human. And also, you just admitted you weren't even sure that you wanted to be in a relationship.
Yeah, because he's a goddamn mess. He is not healthy enough to be in a relationship. Specifically, he needs to be able to have his own identity and motivations before he can have a successful, healthy relationship with anyone else.
Very much so. But like, what makes that moment, what makes all of that stress endearing is there is, after foiling their attempts to defeat the Hound Zodiac several times out of frustration, Shun meets Gen back at the classroom that they're having this supplemental class in, and Gentaro is just in a football uniform. It's not even the school's football uniform, it's just a football uniform.
Where did he even get that? Like,
I don't know.
Did you pick that up at Don Quixote, my dude?
And Gen gives this impassioned speech about how he wants to enter his spirit and take his shape to understand exactly what is driving Shun. And then Shun just turns around in tears and just reveals all of his hang-ups. He's like, I'm only doing all of this so my father will accept and validate me.
My favorite part of this scene was actually how Tomoko is watching and she is so deeply unimpressed by the fountain of manly tears before her.
But like, it's manly tears though, and it's so real and like so vivid. And then it's immediately undercut by everybody discovering that like Yuki gets up and she's like, I'm so impressed that this is happening. Like, everybody's finally exposing their emotions in this classroom. And then Tomoko goes, but we still don't know why you're in supplemental classes though. And that's when Yuki reveals that she's being punished for illegally adding books to the library so she can make space more popular. It's like, what? Okay, that's a thing that you can be punished for, apparently, liking space too much.
I also really appreciate that at the end of this episode, when Shun is just like, so Mew, here we are on the moon. She's just like, yeah, we're not getting back together. I'm so proud of her.
Yes, it's that was so brilliant.
Making healthy choices.
So I guess we could say a lot of things about the rest of the Breakfast Club, because I have a lot of feelings about Tomoko in particular, which we will get to because she has a lot of other things that go on later on.
Tomoko is our craft homage, and she's great.
She's wonderful.
Bisexual witch energy.
So much. And I could do an entire episode about Tomoko, but we can't. So I'm just going to ask a lot of things about the teachers in the school, and in particular about Sonoda-sensei, who we learn a lot of things in this moments very quickly. Eventually, we just learn that she's evil. That's a thing that happens.
Which is actually way better than what I expected for her, because I thought she was going to just get kidnapped a lot.
I mean, yeah. But, like, that reveal, in particular, because the show is very, like, passionately dedicated to the fact that teachers are not trustworthy and don't actually have the best interest of young people at heart, and that you should let young people know themselves and learn themselves and not be like pawns in the game of potential that is played by the adults around them, was actually kind of interesting, considering that the first bad teacher we meet is someone that we've spent several episodes thinking actually cares about his students a great deal, and that we learn that her attachment to the principal in particular is this kind of attachment to the fact that students are supposed to fulfill their potential for these teachers' sake and not for their own sake. I have so many feelings about that I cannot articulate in this much time.
It is a lot.
Yeah. So many things are happening in 4Z.
But the addition of Tomoko to the crew is really great for overall balance of, because mm-hmm. she has this amazing instinctual sense for what a switch can do. which is why Kengo's okay with having her around. Even though he was like, witches aren't real and the apocalypse is bullshit. You have a moon base, but okay, buddy, if this is the line you want to draw about what can exist, I guess I'm not going to argue with that.
I mean, like, again, I have so many feelings about Tomoko in particular, about the fact that so much of her energy is wrapped up in feeling loved and accepted, and whether she needs to find another place to be in order to be her genuine self. And all of the bi energy that is wrapped up in that. But also the fact that in this show that is dedicated to space and the science of space, we have placed this essentially random agent whose entire job is sensing the kind of more fluid spiritual energy behind everything that we technically already have a kind of explanation and sense of logic for, to the point where she can pick up a switch and go, this has the ability to do a thing that it didn't have the ability to do when you made it the first time. And it's only doing that because Gentaro is a good friend. I have so many feelings about Tomoko. Tomoko is my favorite hair, by the way.
She's great, and also her bedroom is super cute.
Her bedroom has dead cicadas in it.
Valid interior design choices.
I mean, that's what makes it interesting to me, because her room becomes an entire reveal where Gentaro goes to her house to try to figure out why she decides she wants to be a witch. And he sees all of these cicadas, he sees the cocoons and the husks of skin, and goes, she's trying to undergo a transformation. This makes sense. And, like, that kind of awareness, again, Gentaro is that good of a friend, but, like, that image being attached to what is essentially the Kamen Rider franchise's word of the day, transformation, was actually kind of revelatory for me. I thought it was a big deal. It was beautiful. And, like, everything about that scene I love. I wish I could, like, the fact that, like, he sees her without her makeup on, and she immediately responds by running all the way out of the house, all the way into the street, just to find a patch of mud somewhere in the tunnel and put it under her eyes so she doesn't feel naked without her makeup. It's like, this identity, this attachment to who you are and how you want to be presented, because this is the only thing that you know about the world, and you're frustrated by being left out and feeling alone in the world. And Gentaro sees this and goes, oh, you want to go to the moon? You know we have a secret base on the moon. I'm just going to show you this thing. It's right here. It's been here the whole time. You can just have it. You can just have this. And it's never going to change. So you don't have to change either. So just all of it is just a very touching moment.
And as we assemble the Breakfast Club, the design of the moon base evolves too. When we get in the first episode, white counters, white walls, almost nothing in this place that is not just functional. Kengo goes there to work. That's it. And then, as Mew declares, we're a club now, and they gain more and more friends, everyone starts moving their shit in. Mew leaves her makeup there. Yuki's got a little desk with her space posters. Jake's bringing in CDs and crap. Tomoko starts bringing her tarot cards and animal skulls up. I think Shun even leaves, like, a football there or something.
Mm-hmm.
But it becomes this accumulation of everybody's clutter, which comes to a head when Kengo gets trapped on the moon, and he is surrounded by the detritus of all these people he doesn't even want to be friends with. And he feels that they're not helping him enough. And how dare they leave all their shit in his space and then leave him to die alone on the moon.
And then when all of that frustration takes place, and in particular the fact that part of why he considers it his space is because he also considers it his father's space. This father that he never knew, who passed away building this secret base for him in the first place, who entrusted it specifically to Kengo. And now he's never going to be able, he thinks that he's never going to be able to leave. And unbeknownst to him, because he's so frustrated and believes that they're not helping him, his friends are literally risking their entire lives to get him off of the moon. To the point where Forze literally just uses the rocket switch and just goes into space. Like, just flies into space and hopes that he could reach there.
Let's briefly talk about how one gets to the moon in the first place, because I'm honestly very surprised that it took us all the way until episode 11 to start having problems with this. The door to space is in a locker in a staff-only storage room. And really, I am surprised that no one got caught going in and out of this room already.
I mean, the room has tape on it that says, do not enter. So I guess people don't enter. It's a bad policy.
Oh no, my concern is like the teachers catching the breakfast club coming in and out of that room clearly labeled, do not enter.
Where are these kids going?
With how often they are going back and forth, really, statistically, they should have been caught by someone by now.
It's not even just that. It's that, like, at that point where, like, around my second rewatch, my immediate assumption was simply, what other negative assumptions are people just avoiding to make about this room? Like, handfuls of teenagers are going into this room for hours at a time. And it's very cramped, so it's not like you can do much much outside of a certain range of horizontal activities, which is a very hostile thought for me to have.
Yeah, it's either making out or it's drugs.
I mean, it would probably make for a very convenient hotbox, because it only has the one window. And the one time you see them open it, it looks like they're having a hard time. But, like, what else is happening in that whole corridor? Like, the entire policy of the gate to the rabbit hutch, to their secret base on the moon, is kind of broken. Because, I mean, it happens by accident, but still. Which is, Kengo receives a package for his birthday, which is just a bright rainbow iridescent switch and a letter saying that it has the capacity to lead you to the secret base. And Kengo sees it and goes, I don't know what to do with this now, and throws it in the locker in front of him. Which is not his locker. It's a broken locker. I don't know why he does that, but still. And then Yuki enters the room and sees that the door is glowing, and suddenly now they can enter this space. It's like, maybe at this point you should have asked the immediate question, why don't we move this locker instead? Why did we do this here now? But yeah, that was a whole thing. And it's made worse by the fact that after a very long and dramatic process of losing that locker, the only thing that can help them in that moment is a very creepy teenager who has the ability to find any object with his Zodiac switch, which is a whole next thing that made me very, very uncomfortable. Makise is the worst. To qualify exactly how bad Makise is, Gantaro in the first, like, 12 episodes of the show has befriended people who have tried to literally kill other people. But he won't befriend Makise because Makise kidnaps 20 teenage girls, puts them on a bus, and tries to drown them.
He's an incel and an MRA, and like, oh my god.
God, I wanted Makise to get beat up.
I'm actually kind of surprised that we got this level of social commentary.
I mean, it's not the only, like, intense height of social commentary we get in the series, because the arc immediately after this is Miura, who we met in episodes 1 and 2, having PTSD.
Yeah, we got real heavy real fast.
Yeah! We immediately learn that all of these other teenagers who have used these Zodiac switches have not come to school in weeks. And Gentaro decides, well, I guess it's our job to bring them back to school. And when he goes to meet Miura, Miura looks them in the eye and goes, I'm not going back to school, because if I go back to school, I will see switches everywhere, and I cannot trust myself to not want one. And I'm going to ruin my life, and I don't want that to happen, so I guess I'll just stay home.
And just pointing out, like, unlike, say, America, where you do, unless you get a GED or something, have to keep going to school until, you graduate high school, in most places in Japan, legally, you can quit after middle school. A lot of people don't, because, you know, lol, economy. Needing degrees.
Fair enough.
But, because they're high school students, Miura technically could drop out without facing any consequences regarding truancy or anything. Mm-hmm. And his family has a business that doesn't require a degree that he could inherit. He basically has an apprenticeship option.
Mm-hmm. And which he was technically already good at.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, part of the reason why Miura is the person that we care about in this moment is also because his girlfriend is very intense and falls into a weeping pile at a moment's notice, which I had a lot of feelings about because, whoa. But yeah, this desire to bring him back specifically so he can experience, like, the good things in his life that he had before he started getting wrapped up in all of this switches business was actually kind of neat. And then it went full dark, because now the switch is a low-key drugs analogy, and yeah, a lot of things were happening in that arc, especially because we meet yet another very evil member of staff in this moment.
Oh my god, the principal.
Oh
my. Notes just say, who's this Otoriakio-looking MF?
Principal Hayami. Otherwise known as the Libra Zodiacs, who has, like, unnecessary power out of nowhere.
The hot teacher is always the evil one.
Yeah, he's pretty evil. I mean, the arc after this one, he literally just controls a teenager's body in order to get that person to kill Gentaro. But that's neither here nor there. People try to kill people all season.
I will say, though, that in Libra form, his earrings are great. He's got style. We have to give him his points for this.
I mean, he generally has style. He's just a very pretty individual overall.
Also, as we're going into the arcs focusing on Libra, it's winter. The red wool duffel coat for the school is great. I especially love how Miu has added a fur collar and cuffs to hers. Extremely stylish.
Mm-hmm. Very good decisions in costume overall, as previously noted. But yeah, like, I kind of have a lot of feelings about teachers in this school that are difficult to qualify, but like,
the good ones are secretly evil, and everybody else is incompetent.
Yeah. I mean, if we're talking incompetence, we should mention Mr. Osugi.
Osugi-sensei! The worst!
Oh my god!
The worst!
The second, like, there are a lot of creeps in this show. Osugi-sensei is particularly kind of creepy.
I wonder if Makise and Osugi are supposed to be parallels or not, because they went there, but I don't know if they went there on purpose.
I don't think it was on purpose. I think we're just, I think we're supposed to find Osugi-sensei delightful and funny and daring. I think we're just supposed to laugh at his sorrowful loneliness, but it's otherwise
so
kind
creepy.
Of creepy that he dedicates entire hours of his life to whether Sonoda likes him. That when Yuki tells him that the locker that they use as the gate to the rabbit hutch is actually Sonoda's locker, he keeps it and takes it to his house so he can fantasize about her taking her clothes off and putting it into the locker. And then he immediately starts assuming that Principal Hayami likes Sonoda, and he's like always just a weeping pile whenever we see him. Like, he goes to the roof for lunch and he sees them both talking there, and he just grips his lunch very sadly and runs down the staircase. It's like, I don't feel sorry for you, my guy. Like, what's happening here? Stop it. Behave. I don't know why they think I'm supposed to find this funny. But at least it's not evil. At least he doesn't try to poison a child.
Yet!
Like Sonoda does.
Like, given the faculty we've seen in the show, I'm not going to take it for granted that Osugi won't be evil by the end.
Oh, you'll be surprised. Well, if I say you'll be surprised, you won't be surprised anymore, will you?
I won't.
But Osugi does a lot of things, and I like him more as the show goes on, but the first few months of this school year, Osugi-sensei is a terrible person. I just have Stop writing men who pine after women so
grossly,
rigorously, that they fantasize about where they put their work clothes while on campus. Like, what the hell? Meh. But again, he doesn't kill children or try to drown children or...
And speaking of terrible harm, I'm coming to children. Let's talk about the Christmas episode.
Huh? Oh, yes.
Boy, that was a bad transition. An accurate one, but not a good one.
Accurate. In context, technically accurate, regardless of what people know about this episode arc. Yes. Which initial catalyst of the Christmas episode is that Yuki, who wrote what is, I personally believe, is a badass song about the Hayabusa satellite and performed it at the Queen Fest in episode 3. Yuki is confronted by the Glee Club, who ask her very nicely, "Hey, would you like to sing this song with us as we visit our kindergarten and sing for these kids who we sing for every year?" And she's like, "I mean, yeah, let's do the thing. Anything to make space popular." And while that's happening, another student who typically paints a new painting for those same kindergarten children every year is like struck with this intense frustration that everybody is breaking his concentration and focuses specifically on the Glee Club and how much he hates their singing and wishes that they would stop. And he tries to kill them on regular occasions because he has been gifted a Zodiac switch by Principal Hayami, otherwise known as the Libra Zodiac. I'm trying to remember what form it is, but I cannot remember. All I remember is... Right! I do remember. It's the Perseus Zodiac, because its right hand has Medusa's head on it.
Yes.
And can turn people to stone. And we know that because he just turns Gentaro into a whole statue. Just... Nope! Gentaro's just gone for almost a whole episode. That was... I have a lot of feelings, specifically about Libra and Libra's behavior and justification during this episode, because he continually goes to Sonoda after and not only lets the audience know that he was the person who gave Sonoda her switch when she was a teenager, but that his entire logic is wrapped around the idea that the student's potential is really his potential, and they only succeed because he's good and virtuous and has power and aptitude. And if another kid doesn't, it's because the person who trained them and gave them their switch is bad and cannot be trusted. It's like, what the hell? These are children who have their own inner lives. And you just wrapped up this student's entire capacity for doing harm to other people and whether they can paint to the point where they're willing to cause harm in order to continue doing something that they love and find valuable. And that's kind of nasty. But at least Gentaro gets to save the day in a kind of hindsight by drawing like a child.
I have to admit that the pen switch is actually my favorite switch.
I mean, I kind of like it, but only because it has a totally weird secondary ability, which is everything that it draws turns to iron out of nowhere. But like, I like the fact that that is a switch that he was given, that he is put in his position to be weirdly artistic as a result.
It actually leads to this really great background gag during the fight in episode 16, because when Gentaro first tests the switch, he writes "baka, idiot" in katakana on the wall of the testing room. And later, you see Jake holding up just the "ka." And without the context, katakana ka
passes for the kanji for power.
Ooh!
So you just see Jake holding up this, basically, a sign that says power in the background of the fight.
Especially because, like, I actually, there's another gag that happens there that I'm sure you know better than me because you do education stuff presently. When Jake throws the switch for Gentaro and says, this is a pen. Which, I'm sure most of the internet knows that joke.
If I never hear this is a pen again, it will still be too soon. I just...
Oh god.
It's just such classic Eikaiwa that gets parodied in everything.
I believe it. But like, part of why I like those two episodes is because it reinforces a thing that most of the series reinforces, but does it in a very much more neater and concise way for me, which is how earnest Gentaro is, because he's willing to challenge a trained painter at a painting duel and takes a crayon and one sheet of paper and draws a mountain so bad that Perseus Zodiacs, otherwise known as Motoyama, looks at him and goes, is that a rocket? What's this supposed to be? But the fact that he can do that with that kind of earnestness is the only reason why they, not only why they are capable of defeating him, but why they're able to convince him, you could just put the switch down whenever you want and come back to doing this thing that you like. And that's when Libra decides, nope, if you're really going to do that, then I guess I'll just brainwash you instead. And like, even the process of getting out of that becomes the process of saving this kid's life for his own sake and reinforcing the things that he loves and the things that he values. And that only happens. He only has that kind of will to be in that position because he's been convinced by the worst artist that he has ever met that all that matters is being true to your own work. Like, I have as someone who cannot draw, I have feelings, but like, just that kind of pure earnestness is something that we are sorely lacking in the world in general.
Well, remember, this was made in 2011. A brighter time.
A brighter time.
The before time.
Yes. Back before the apocalypse was nigh at all moments. But yeah, I like Forze for a lot of reasons, but mostly just because, like, a lot of this boundaryless teenage boy named Kisaragi Gentaro is the process of just reminding other young people that the things that they do and want are valuable and that they can do those things without causing harm to each other or being tied up in the machinations of other people, especially adults who don't care about them or like them.
I really love the friendships in this series.
It's just everything that was good in Persona 4 now with Kamen Riders.
and a special handshake.
The handshake is so goddamned heartwarming.
Yeah.
I melt a little every time it happens.
Yeah, the fact that it becomes a moment that you need to stop and observe every time that it happens. Like, the handshake happens in slow motion whenever he gets a new friend.
I cheered when Mew did it in episode 4. But like, in episode 11 or 12? When Kengo finally gives in and does the handshake. That was when I cried.
Right?
I didn't expect to cry this early into the series.
This is my fifth time watching it, and I cry when Shun cries every time. So I'll tell you, just take it as it comes. Accept the tears willingly. Tears are the seasoning of youth, as Gentaro would say himself.
And that's the moral of today's episode, friends.
Oh yes, definitely. So, this is the part where I tell you that we have, of course, the next 16 episodes of Forze to watch, which I'm particularly excited about because I'm aware of a thing that is particularly neat, because at the end of episode 16, we briefly meet a new character who has not been named, so I'm not going to name him, but there is a new writer in the series.
I preemptively don't like him. I'm sorry. His belt makes these really dumb kung fu noises that I hate.
Oh yes, like that's his thing. His thing is, what if a meteor knew Jeet Kune Do? He's just Bruce Lee in space, yeah, is it? I think it's the funniest thing in the world. But we're going to learn more about him as we continue. And if anybody's watching along, because I know that I'm going to put some links to krdl.moe in the rider notes of the show, I'm going to specifically suggest that instead of watching episodes 17 to 32, you look for episodes 17 to 30 and a special episode called the Kamen Rider Forze Climax episode, which will be the director's cut of 31 and 32. You can watch it either way, but I personally am looking forward to watching the climax episode instead of those two episodes as they aired on TV. So we can have a lot more feelings about that character, about Gentaro, and about the power of maintaining friendships. So yeah, I hope that you all venture with us in the deep space of this show as we continue.
I've enjoyed this journey into space.
I'm glad that you have. So with that, I have been Brandon.
And I'm still Iori, and intend to continue being Iori for the foreseeable future.
And I hope that we see you in school next episode. Don't press that switch, please. It's only going to hurt you in the long run.
In the meantime, be transformed.
And stay righteous.
Thank you for listening to Righteous Kicks, a member of the Skiffy and Fanti Network. If you'd like to contact us, you can do so at skiffyandfanti@gmail.com, or you can contact the hosts, Brandon O'Brien and Iori Cusano, directly at righteouskickscast@gmail.com. You can find them individually on Twitter at TheRisingTithes or at Iori Cusano. If you are interested in other podcasts in the Skiffy and Fanti Network, please visit us at skiffyandfanti.com. If you would like to support the network, you can do so at patreon.com/skiffyandfanti. Keep up to date with all of the things at the Skiffy and Fanti Network by going to skiffyandfanti.com/newsletter. Music from this podcast is from Kamen Rider Love Song, used with permission from the band Berserk.